to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us today, Bill?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pape has everything you possibly could think of when it comes to John Deere. They've recently purchased the Valley Truck and Tractor franchise down in the Northern Valley. Additional 9 locations, so they've got it pretty well covered. If you need anything, John Deere, they have access to it. So you can give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
So they go from Sacramento, pretty much, like Yuba City, all the way to what, Idaho?
Idaho, but they go down below Woodland now. And they've got about 120 locations now. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah. So in hard times, they're managing to figure it out and keep the doors open and actually expand a little bit. So that's good for them.
And it's family owned and operated.
That's right.
Should point that out. Okay. So let's see. Just by way of information, you can always find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Our archives go back, 11 years. I guess we're in year 12-ish, and they're all commercial-free, and they're all free to listen to. So, got topics on everything. We have tabs on the top for things that we do a lot of shows on. One of the shows is marijuana. I just put pot on the tab for the top, and we have a really good doctor coming on with us next week from Australia, so don't miss that if that's a hot topic for you. We're looking to do some really interesting things here in the North State with the Daily Caller to get the word out on what's happening with the cartel marijuana grows here. Since everybody thinks it's just an herb and it's not hurting anyone.
It's all natural.
Oh, yeah, it's natural. I forgot about that one. So he will be the story he sent me was 21st century snake oil. So I think we kind of know. Think we know what's going on there. He's got a lot of information on CBD and how that's not quite as harmless as people would like to believe, or how they're being told anyway. He's just kind of all in it for the health. So let's see. Today we have two really cool guests that we have never – well, second guy we've spoken with, Peter Wood, we've spoken with. His topic is wrath, America enraged. So kind of interesting that it worked out that we have William Damon on the first hour, a round of golf with my father – is the topic on his, and he's talking about a life review as a way to a happier life, I guess. I'm not gonna paraphrase his book, that would be silly. But he's a professor at Stanford University, the director of the Stanford Center on Adolescence, and a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's the author of a new book, A Round of Golf with My Father, A New Psychology of Exploring Your Past to Make Peace with Your Present. And then you're going to figure out what to do with your wrath in the second hour. kind of a little self-help theme we got going on today. And so I'm assuming that Mr. Damon is on the line with us.
I am. Hello.
Nice. You're very quiet.
Well, I didn't want to interrupt you.
No, not while I was, riffing here at the beginning. So are you William Call Me William or William Call Me Bill?
Call Me Bill.
that'll be easy to remember.
Well, Bill, here's Bill. Okay. So two Bills and an Aaron on this one. So I thought your topic was really an interesting idea. I have no idea where you'd like to start with this, but why don't you just kind of take it away, because I think it's a cool idea.
Well, I'll start where I started from. I had a family mystery that I never really knew what happened to my father. My father disappeared from my life at my birth. And for the first, 20 years or so of my life, I thought he was killed in World War II. He was over fighting in Germany. And my mother always would tell me he was missing in World War II. Then I found out when I was in college from my mother that he actually was still alive. But it was really clear that he had just abandoned us. And I did not want to know anything more about him at that time. I figured he was a no-account scoundrel. I figured he was irresponsible. And I was a young man. I didn't want to identify with a negative role model. I just was not interested. And so for the rest of my life, until I reached about age 60, I just ignored every clue that came up or any time anybody ever mentioned anything about him. But one day I got a call from my daughter, who was maybe about 30 at the time, and she got interested in the grandfather she never met. Turns out that she dug up a lot of stuff online about him, because he was dead at that time, but he had a pretty significant life. He was a war hero in some ways. He then went into the War Department, the Foreign Service, served our country in Germany, then Southeast Asia, started a second family after he divorced my mother, and had a couple of kids who I then got to meet. So all of this family mystery opened up for me, and it made me realize that, you know, you can't just bury your past, because I also discovered at the time that I was doing this that I actually had a lot of resentments about him disappearing and kind of regrets about growing up as an only child without a father. And I just never paid attention to it. I figured, you know, you should always look forward in life, don't look back. And I do think it is really important to look forward in life and don't look back. But what I discovered and what I wrote about in the book is that the way to liberate yourself from the past is not to just pretend it didn't exist, but to confront it, deal with your regrets, try to understand the mysteries, understand how you got to be the person you are now, and then you're more prepared to be at peace with your present and move forward with your life. And that's really what the book is about. I'll explain the title. The title sounds like it's a golfing book, which it's not. The title is kind of symbolic, but I'll explain that as we talk some more.
Wow. So when your daughter told you that she had been looking into you, how'd that kind of make you feel at first?
Well, it actually, at that time in my life, which was late, as I said, I was 60-ish at the time, I was ready to hear it, and I just got fascinated by it. If she had called 20 years before, or if I had found out 30 years before, I would have gone through my usual routine at that time of just feeling uncomfortable, not wanting to hear about it, and so on. But I was ready to hear it. I was a grown-up person, stable. I had my own family, my own life, and it was not threatening to me. And the stuff she found was fascinating. That was the other thing. It was thrilling. First of all, there was his career, which, as I said, he was a distinguished diplomat, got to know the king and queen of Thailand, lots of things like that. But the thing that really blew me away, and I will get to the title of the book, is that in that information she dug up online, it was an oral history from the United States Information Agency, which had done an oral history on a friend of his, and then he had a whole section in his history about Phil Damon, my father. And the guy said, one thing about Phil Damon, he was a great golfer. Now, I love golf, and I am very far from a great golfer. And when I heard that, I was fascinated by it, and I have to admit, at that time, waves of resentment kind of passed through me, because I thought, you know, this guy was a great golfer. How come he couldn't come by even once to teach me how to play the game? I could never afford lessons. We grew up in a not very privileged financial situation, because he left my mother alone, and I was an only child with a single mother. I could never afford golf lessons. So I immediately realized I've got to deal with this, because I didn't even know I had these resentments. And the book is called A Round of Golf with My Father, because in the course of my research about the guy, when I really did get interested, I found a new cousin that I never knew about, who had in his family garage an old set of my father's golf clubs from when he was young. And in that set of golf clubs was a scorecard made out with my father's score from a country club he played on. So I went to the country club. They let me play a round of golf on it, and I played against his scorecard.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a symbolic kind of exercise. He obviously wasn't really there, so it was not a round of golf with my father, except in my mind. But it was I found it to be a kind of a redeeming experience. It gave me a sense of, first of all, a little bit of what kind of life he had earlier, something admirable. I could see how well he played. And this is symbolic of other things, because I found a lot of things about him to respect. And eventually it even gave me a pathway to forgiving him in some ways, even though that was hard, because he did hurt my mother, among other things. But forgiveness is important to strive for, even if it's difficult. And I did have a pathway to respecting him and forgiving him. And that round of golf with my father, which is the title of the book, was symbolic of the whole enterprise I did. And you mentioned the life review. I reviewed my life, his life, my mother's life. And that's a whole psychological method that I write about in the book. And anybody can do this. And I found it to be a great way to clear up family mysteries, to deal with old resentments and regrets that you may not even recognize you have, and move forward with optimism and confidence to a purposeful future, which is, sure, of course, the point of everything.
Well, here you had a dad you could be proud of the whole time, and you didn't. I mean, you would never have known that.
Exactly. And that was one of the lessons I learned in my journey, was that, you know, it's important to deal with these things and have the conversations with people that may be awkward. I never confronted my mother. She had hidden the story of my father from me for the first 20 years of my life, and then when she finally revealed it, it was so uncomfortable and awkward, I just avoided it. But that was a mistake, and it was a regret that I had that I never did that while she was still alive. And that's one of the lessons. I have some lessons that I express in the book, and one of the lessons is have the conversations with your loved ones before it's too late.
Sure. Now, when he remarried, did he remarry in Europe and live there, or did he return to the United States?
No, he never really came back to the United States, except for brief periods of time. He married after he divorced my mother, he married a French ballerina. Who he met in Germany. He was stationed in Germany, and she was dancing in a Jean Cocteau ballet. And he met her after the performance and fell in love with her and married her. And they, and then they were restationed about 3 or 4 years later. He was, the State Department sent him to Southeast Asia, and he spent the rest of his career in Thailand with her. And they had a couple of daughters, and she started a ballet school in Thailand where the queen sent her children to. So they had a pretty dramatic life. And I got to have a couple of conversations with Genevieve, who was still alive, even though my father was passed away by the time I discovered this. But I did get to meet Genevieve, his second wife, and I've become close with my half-sisters.
How fun is that?
Yeah.
You know, kind of one of those things, you thought you were an only child, and then, ba-bam, you know, you got a family.
Exactly.
And they're kind of neat.
Exactly. I wish I'd started it a few years earlier, but better late than never.
Sure. And I guess as I was reading just the synopsis that you had sent, I thought, you know, if that doesn't just say it all, you know, people wait and wait and wait, and then they look back, and I think really one of the hardest things for people to get over, if they ever do, is regret.
Exactly.
It's a terrible, terrible thing.
I have a whole chapter in the book about dealing with regret, and also how you think about memories. You know, memories are tricky because they're never exactly accurate. So
sure,
part of the life review is checking out what really did happen, meeting some of the people who may be elderly who remember you as a child and know about your family.
Well, how many kids out there have a skewed view of what went on in their childhood, and there were all sorts of factors at play that didn't make sense to them as a kid? We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, let's pick that up, because that, I think, is a big thing for a lot of people, and I think it's neat the way you dealt with it in the book. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People. Our guest is Bill Damon, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I guess that's how it's meant to be, and I find more and more like him each day. I notice I walk the way he walks. I notice I talk the way he talks. I'm starting to see my father.
Happen to have a stash of dad songs. Little stash of dad songs because, oddly enough, when my dad came, he was here a few years ago, and he was going to be here on Father's Day. And I thought, wow, there wouldn't be anything more fun than doing a show on Father's Day about dads, you know, and then have my dad there. That would be cool. And so we taped a show, and this was 2019, and turned out he died the next year, and that was the last time I saw him. So, seize the moment.
You've got to do these things when you have time. That's great, though, that you did it.
Yeah, pretty, I think people, you know, because you think, well, I'm busy. But kids, to go back to that kid thing, I know people, okay, I might be related to them, who have... I'm the oldest of five kids, and they have, like, really skewed memories about some of the things when we were kids. Nothing, you know, call the police about or anything. We didn't have that exciting a childhood. But just things that happened or didn't happen.
Yeah.
And really odd. It's like, wait a minute, I was there. No, that didn't happen like that.
Oh, that's, yeah, and that's one thing in my field, which is psychology. That's one thing we know is that people unintentionally make up whole stories that never happened or remember things in the opposite way that they were. When I did my life review that was triggered by this family discovery that I had, I found from my old school records that teachers said things about me that were completely different than the way I remembered. Looking back to my early adolescence, you know, you're always kind of awkward when you're a teenager. I remembered myself as being shy, withdrawn. Everybody else was smarter than me, better athlete, etc. But several of my teachers in my records said, oh, Bill is friendly, gregarious, he's well-liked. That was a whole different perspective that I found by looking up old records. And I was thinking, you know, I did this, of course, story on my father and found out about his life. And as I said, I found out from his military records that he had some very courageous episodes during World War II and after World War II when he was serving in the War Department in small towns in Germany, getting them to get rid of the Nazis and get the Democrats in office and all that kind of thing. He had a lot to be proud of. But I think that it turned out when I met my half-sisters, he had never talked about any of that to them. And, of course, about me, he shut down any conversations. They asked him, what is it about this William? And he would slam his hand on the table and say, we don't talk about William here. He must have felt really bad about that period in his life. And that was a regret that he probably never dealt with. And I have a lot of sympathy for the guy, even though he abandoned me, because I think he was kind of tormented by that, because the whole point of the life review is clearing up that, figuring out what you can learn from the mistakes you've made, finding out things that were positive, that you can feel proud of, that maybe you're forgetting and misremembering. So memories are very unreliable, and it's, to me, I found it amazingly helpful to go back and find out as much as I can about what really did happen, what my life was really like, what my father and my mother's lives were like, meeting some of the old friends that they had who were maybe in their 90s at that point, but they had a lot of information about what these what happened in the early part of my life, which was very foggy in my memory and probably not even accurate.
So your half siblings knew about you growing up, but you didn't know about them?
Yeah, that's right. As I said, my mother kind of encased me in a bubble of ignorance about all this stuff. But my half-sisters knew my father's younger sister, who was my aunt, and who I got to meet. She's passed away now, but after I discovered all this finally, I got to meet her in my 60s and became close with her. And my aunt had heard about me. I'm a psychologist. I've written books about human development growing up, and some of them have become kind of popular. And so my aunt knew all about me because of that and mentioned me to her nieces who wanted to know more about me. But my father shut it down, just like my mother shut everything down on my end. So, I think maybe that generation, or maybe just those two people, were not very open about these things and didn't feel right about the way their marriage disintegrated. But I think they would have done us a much better favor if they had talked to all of us about it. And I wish I'd gotten to know my other side of my family years, decades earlier than I did.
Right. Yeah, because that's kind of a generational thing, isn't it? About talking about your personal past with other people.
I think so. Yeah, I think that was the so-called greatest generation, and they were heroic in a lot of ways. They made it through the Great Depression, the World War II, but it was kind of a don't explain, don't complain ethic, and they didn't really talk about their feelings very much. I'm a baby boomer, and, we have a whole different ethic of open up, be open. And in some ways, I think it helps us to be open and to talk honestly and be frank. You know, I quote in my book the great Frank Sinatra, who sang, I think the line is something like, "Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention." And I said, this is a very plucky attitude, and it's brave, but it's not necessarily the best recipe for psychological well-being. It kind of helps to come to terms and to say, yeah, I do have these regrets, and they keep popping up unless I deal with them and figure out what they mean and figure out what I've learned from them, figure out in the perspective of the fact that I overcame them, that I have survived, I prevailed. There's a lot of things to feel good about if you confront honestly the things that have been difficult in your past.
Yeah. So in your profession, do you run into a lot of people that have similar pasts that they just recently discovered?
Yeah, especially since my book has come out, which is fairly recently, I've gotten a lot of emails and messages from people that say, gee, I had somebody disappear from my family too, or I've got these mysteries that I never knew about and I never wanted to know about, but maybe I should. So, I'm amazed actually at how many families have these kind of mysteries in them.
Yeah, and once you have that kind of stuff in there, people do one of two things. They make a whole narrative around it and then proceed to make their life about that. Or they just let it be like a, you know, the proverbial pebble in the shoe.
Yeah, unspoken.
That's very well said. Yeah, and in both cases, you know, it could be cleared up by just figuring out what really happened, what it means, and then getting past it. I quote Faulkner in the book, which, you know, Faulkner famously wrote, the past is not dead. It is not even past, because it is part of who we are. And it helps to recognize that, and that's how you build a future for yourself, is knowing who you are at this time, how you got to be that way, and what are the best parts of you, and what are the best parts of your experience, and move those forward. And the mistakes or the things that didn't go right, accept them. Say, that's part of life, and affirm who you are. And the only way to do that is to understand what happened in your life and how you got to be the person you are now.
Yeah, you think of all the... I don't know, there's rarely a thing that comes on the news about somebody with... you know, who's done usually something bad, because we don't have news stories about people who do things that are good for some unknown reason.
That's great.
I guess we call them the unsung heroes. But like when they've done something bad, you know, it's like, oh, well, what about their parents? You know?
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times it's their recollection of what happened. And then there are other people,
yeah.
I guess that's the mystery of human nature. There are other people who really did have crappy parents and crummy lives growing up, and they do amazing things.
Yep.
So it's like,
So that's the other message, is that, you know, it ain't over till it's over. You know, you can have all kinds of things that you really do kind of mourn in your life that really were not good, and lots of us have those things. But we do the best we can, and we're still here. And a lot of people, as you said, they even build huge strengths on some of the disasters that have happened to them. Quoting another great author, Hemingway said, "Life breaks everyone in some way, but many people are strongest at their broken places." And that's not an exact quote, but that's my paraphrase of what I think he wrote. But, you know, there's a message there, which is that we can and we do overcome things. And that's something that gives us a sense of satisfaction if we can remember that correctly. And part of the challenge is trying to remember what actually did happen and remember how you did overcome the things that were really, really, really hard in your life.
Yeah, you're like the other side of the... what is it? Don't let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Right.
You're like, you know, maybe I'll try some facts. So,
and you can make a great story out of the real facts.
Right. It's not always a dead end. So the siblings that you, I guess, inherited, how's that? Where are they?
Well, they're still in Thailand. That's where my father had his career. So I don't get to see them very often, but they do come over here. And I should mention that I also discovered two male cousins who are just a little bit younger than me, who are great people, and I get to see them more often because they're in this country. They were the sons of my aunt, who I discovered, and as I said, she passed away, but I became close with her before she did, and my cousins are my pals, my male cousins.
Wow, and so without this research, I mean, I'm kind of, you know, keeping a little score chart here in my head, would you have any relatives?
Very few. I grew up as an only child. My mother never remarried. I did have one cousin, but he lived in New Jersey. I was living in Massachusetts, so I only saw him once every couple of years. I like him a lot, and he's older, and I still see him from time to time. But he was it, and so it wasn't much of an extended family. And so it's, and my wife has three siblings, so, you know, I know from her what it's like to have a real family, and I always envied that, but now I've got my own version of it.
Wow, so this was kind of a bonanza for you.
Yeah, I know. And so that was, yeah, so, you know, I had the psychological benefits of doing this life review, and that's what I write about in the book, but I've also had personal and family benefits of discovering family members I never knew I had.
That's totally cool. There's got to be a whole lot of people out there that are thinking, well, you know, my dad or our mom, but it seems like more often than not it's the dad. And we have a lot of kids now being raised in single parent homes, and I don't think anybody has missed, you know, the stories of, oh, your dad's a terrible person and he ditched us and all that. Meanwhile, the dad spent the last penny he had trying to, you know, get visitation with his kids and was prevented from that. And the kids never wind up knowing the story.
Right.
And
I
would think that, you know, something like this, if they went back and did the real homework, we have to take another break here. I don't want to cut this in the middle, but I'm curious. So when maybe when we come back, you could tell us as a psychologist, you know, when reality really, really conflicts with the story you've been told your whole life, you know, what's the reconciliation process for that? Because I think if my mom had lied to me my whole life about who my dad was and I found out it was totally different, that's a whole different that's like a whole different problem. You opened up a different box. We'll be right back with our guest, William Damon. He has written a book called A Round of Golf with My Father, The New Psychology of Exploring Your Past to Make Peace with Your Present. What a cool idea. We should all do more of that. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Nice job, Bill.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll do my best to do the best I can. I'll do my best to do the best I can. To keep my feet from jumping from the ground, dear. To keep my heart from jumping through my mouth, dear. To keep the past and not the present. To try and learn when you teach me a
Right. It is more than a feeling, isn't it? Because right now feelings run the world. We're going to learn about that next hour. We're going to have to make that stop. It's completely out of control. So what do you think, Bill, about the misremembering of things or being told things by one parent?
Yeah. Well, of course, some version of that is what happened to me when my mother said, your father is missing in World War II, and that's all she said about him. And so number one, here's my treatment of this as a psychologist and the way I write about it in the book. First of all, if people are still alive, it's never too late to have an initiative to try to open things up. And it's amazing what even a letter or an email can do or a phone call, and you never should give up on a relationship, even if you feel you've been estranged from the person or the person doesn't want anything to do with you. You can always give it a shot, and I have heard of a lot of cases of that leading to not necessarily hugs and you know, smiles all around, but at least the beginning of a relationship. And I could not do that with my mother or my father because they were both dead at the time I found out about this. But I did approach my father's younger sister, who was in her 80s at the time, and she was amazingly receptive and open and warm to me. And I had no reason to know that would be the case. For all I knew, she was going to just slam the phone down. But no, it turned out that she wanted to talk to me. And I learned a lot about everything from talking to her, about my father's early life, about what happened to him after he entered the Army. So it's never too late to have conversations with people if they're still alive. And part of that is also forgiving them if they abandoned you or if they did something that wasn't in your interest early on. You can try to understand why. And when I did a treatment of my father's life, I could understand how he was very young when I was born, in his maybe 20 or 21 years old, over in Germany under an enormous amount of pressure, rising to the occasion as a military, he was in Army intelligence, a very dangerous and difficult task, and he rose to the occasion under a lot of pressure, a young guy over in Europe. And I can understand how at that time in his life he could make this kind of this irresponsible decision not to come back to his responsibilities as a new father of a young kid, just married my mother quickly. So I could get some sympathy for him. I also needed to have some sympathy for myself because I avoided those conversations with my mother all those decades. But I could understand why, because I had a difficult childhood without a father. I felt hurt by it, and I wanted to avoid it. So forgiveness all around helps in establishing relationships. And then, finally, if the people are not alive and not available to have those conversations, you can find out a lot about them, and you can learn who they were. And it's not the same, obviously, as having a real relationship with them, but you can fill in huge pieces of your life by bringing them to life and finding out about what they were like, looking up old records that they might have left, meeting some of their friends. And that, I think, goes a long way to helping, at least in my case, it went a long way to helping me fill in this kind of mysterious gap in my life that I felt I never really understood myself very well, or how I grew up or how I got to be the person I am until I went through this process. So that's the life review. It's meeting and having conversations with the people who are still available. It's searching for old records and meeting their friends if they're no longer alive and available. It's understanding yourself and understanding why your memories may not be exactly right, and trying to correct them, and forgiving yourself for not getting around to doing this earlier in your life. Because after all, and this is the bottom line, everyone makes mistakes in life. Everyone. I make mistakes. Every human being. Nobody's perfect. And so putting that in perspective and understanding that really helps you then move forward, which is what you want to do in establishing these relationships and developing that understanding that helps you move forward in a positive way.
I would imagine it kind of shuts off a lot of old resentment. Do you find that, I mean, you'd live the bulk of your life thinking one thing. Can you tell? Does it make you, I mean, it seems like you would be happier.
Yeah, I mean, that's, as I said, that those resentments were there all along, but I was not recognizing them and I was not dealing with them. But they would pop up. It's, you know, you can't put a lid, it's like trying to put a lid on a boiling pot of water. It keeps bubbling over. And when I really took the time to figure out, first of all, what I was resentful about, and then understanding that in perspective of my whole life. I've, like everybody, I've had a life. I'm grateful for that. And there were a lot of the things that were difficult in my life actually led to strengths that I developed. Growing up without a father, I learned to do a lot of things for myself and stand up for myself. And so understanding that and finding a way to feel good about some of the difficulties I had rather than feeling sorry for myself was very healthy. And part of that was recognizing that, yeah, I did resent that, and I am still angry about that. But now I confront it. I understand it. I put it in perspective. And that anger then just goes away. It just melts into a sense that, you know, I've had a life. I've had a life that I can feel grateful about. I have contributed to the world. I have my own family. I have three kids of my own. I mean, I'm lucky. I've had a very good run in life. And so what's there to feel sorry about? But I couldn't really do that until I really openly confronted the things in the past that I felt uncomfortable with, and they were always there hanging around, and until I really understood them and put them in perspective, they did not go away.
It's interesting. I think we all make decisions based on, yeah, that stuff that lurks in the basement.
Yeah.
You know, how many times have you heard, well, she's got daddy issues?
But, you know, I'll say one other thing.
I don't know
why
it's always the women who have the daddy issues, but...
Everyone's got daddy issues, I think. And mom issues, too, by the way.
Yeah, true.
But let me say one thing, because, you know, I also don't want to sound like this was all just kind of a hard trudge through unpleasant memories, because the other thing I found is that this stuff is fascinating. When I actually started looking into it, it got me into history. I learned about the history of World War II and America in Germany after the war, and these amazing lives that my parents had and my ancestors had. And going back to read in old school records, I read letters that my grandparents wrote about my father to the school.
Oh, no kidding.
It's thrilling. It was really fun. So it wasn't just this kind of painful. I mean, there were painful parts to it, but that wasn't all. There was a lot of it was just exciting and fun and kind of amateur history, which is amazing to do.
Yeah, because I guess it could sound like, hey, want to do a life review? It's like one of the other choices.
No, I mean it's you know, if you look up your old school records and see what some of your teachers said, some of it makes you laugh. It's not that dreary or unpleasant at all. It's and history is amazingly interesting. Let's face it, and the history of our country, it's an amazing. We live in an amazing country with a lot of stuff to admire and to just feel fascinated by.
Well, the cool part is now your kids have, I have a grandfather on my dad's side. They had always said that he was born in New York, but we didn't know we knew about his mom, but nothing about his dad, who came from Ireland. And before my uncle died, when he was in his late 80s, before he died, so it was probably, 5 years ago maybe, he discovered a ship's manifest that showed that my grandfather came here when he was 3.
Holy cow.
From Ireland. It's like, well, I'm thinking, yeah, he wasn't born in New York then.
Yeah.
That probably
wow.
didn't happen, and he was probably an illegal alien.
You see, and you and your kids, can you imagine how interesting that is about it? And even finding out all the surrounding historical details on that. You know, what was it like to come in? I don't know. He must have come into Ellis Island, I guess.
Yeah, probably.
Something like that.
I don't know.
And just learning about that is a whole education in itself.
See, the family mythology was that his mom got pregnant really young and they sent her to America. It's
wow.
Like, okay, you Irish pregnant girl, you know, go to America. Nobody will notice. But yeah. The ship's manifest said there was a Hugh Bartholomew Ryan who was like 17 and Hugh Bartholomew Ryan, who was three, and then I don't know, we always called her Ma Dugan, the mom, but Mary Dugan, and she was like 15. So these people had my grandfather when they were in junior high. It's like, wow, what was going on in our family?
Yeah. You know, if I were you, I might make a trip back to Ireland to where they came from.
Oh, my uncle went all the time. He searched searched. Oh, my God, he went every year and he searched. The Icelandic side's pretty easy, though. They said that they carried a boat across Canada to arrive in Tacoma, Washington. And it's like, yeah, they probably didn't do that from Iceland, carry a boat. that probably mostly didn't happen.
That's some rugged folks right there.
So, I come from a long line of storytellers. Little difficulty separating the fact from fiction unless it was really over the top. But, you know, for a group of people who really, you know, talks with their hands and uses axes really well, I guess you don't argue with their crazy stories that much.
No, that's right. That's right. No, but, and storytelling is fun, too. I mean, that's part of what I'm saying is the stuff is, I could see why somebody would go over there every year because it's really a neat thing to do.
It kind of drove my uncle nuts. I mean, he dug and he dug and he dug. I mean, he was diligent. And he only came out with that after years of looking. He discovered this ship's manifest and put the pieces together. And what are the odds? There's a guy and his kid both named Hugh Bartholomew Ryan. Really? Like right
well,
exactly
you know,
at the same time?
Hmm. And it feels like you're finding like a little diamond in the rough or something, a jewel when that happens. It's so thrilling. That's what happened when I did research on my father. I discovered that he had been ordered after the war to testify at a trial that involved some prisoners being abused and stuff like that. And I dug up transcripts of some of his testimony. Just amazing that it had just been lost to history. And I also dug up a little history book where he was actually mentioned when he was in London there for that trial. And it even had a little section about him going to a British pub and kinds of little jewels that were just so exciting and fun to bring all of this stuff from the 1940s, the late 1940s, to life.
Well, having the transcripts from the trial, I mean, you can almost hear your father's voice.
Yeah, you can hear him talking.
You know, talking and is, you know.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh, fellers, we are out of time. Got about 15
so
seconds
much.
Here.
I really enjoyed being with you guys.
Yeah, really, really cool topic and a great book. I hope people pick it up. A Round of Golf with My Father by William Damon. I think
it's available on Amazon.
Yeah, I think we could all. I'll link a copy of the book actually. And
oh, good.
I think we could all use a little life review, huh? Maybe we'd be happier. We wouldn't have to talk about Wrath the next hour. Thank you so much.
Good.
Thanks, Bill.
Great talking to you guys. Bye.
You're listening to We the People. You can find us at
wethepeopleradio.us.
Don't stop believing. You won't believe that I am not the same as you. What a shot you could be if you could shoot at me with those angry eyes.
I couldn't resist. I had to switch up the song.
Went right to angry.
I went right to angry. There were some good angry songs out there.
Yeah.
So in honor of Peter Wood's book, Wrath, I thought we should have some. We should have some songs about that.
Yeah.
Got to be stuff out there.
They're out there.
It turns out we were listening to them in the 70s and didn't even know what they were about. We thought they were nice songs by Loggins and Messina, just, you know, singing in their folksy way. And it's like, wow, I listened to it and I thought about there's a story in his book that about people who shoot each other with a shovel in snow. And it's like, they had the angry eyes going on there, I guess. So second hour of We the People. And my name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Clindiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape has got everything going on with John Deere. You want tractors, attachments, mowers. They have it all up there. Parts, sales, and service. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or you can give them a call at 226-9226. They got lots to choose from up there. They're also a steel power products dealer and a Honda dealer. So go up and check them out. Or you can catch them online. They have a nice website, papemachinery.com. You can actually go in there and price your own tractor, build it yourself, and see what kind of dollars you're looking at. So give them a shout.
It's free to build an imaginary tractor.
Yeah.
You don't have to pay for it until you actually go get the real thing.
Nope.
Kind of a
deal. Do, however, miss the opportunity to talk to our number one salesman up there because he's got a lot of information and he can really help you through the process.
Okay, so maybe you should just go in. Okay, forget that.
All right, we're confused.
Forget your imaginary tractor. It's just silly. It's a waste of time.
Yeah,
okay, so I've been really looking forward to this. So Peter Wood has been on our program before. He has written a new book. He's the president of the National Association of Scholars and the author of Wrath, America Enraged, as well as last year's acclaimed 1620, and that's what we spoke with him before about. And 1620 was a critical response to the 1619 project. So with all the stuff going on with the critical race theory and all that, if you haven't read 1620, you might want to go pick up a copy. He is a former professor of anthropology and a college provost. He's the author of several books about American culture, including Diversity, The Invention of a Concept, and A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America Now. And that was back in 2007 when we thought everything
that was... That was calm.
We thought everything was magical. How could he be worse than this, right?
Yeah.
So we've been reading the book, and it is great and extremely timely. So Peter, we'll just kind of let you take it away because, frankly, this is the. I mean, it's like you reached right into America and pulled out the hottest topic going.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious why wrath? I mean, that's a great topic.
Well, I think I was set off this time by the 2020 presidential election, and then the riot in the Capitol, and the way it got ballooned afterwards into the so-called insurrection.
Yeah.
So
they were going to overtake the government, but they forgot to bring weapons. Oops.
They forgot to bring weapons, and they basically didn't hurt anybody, but now we know two of the protesters were killed in the midst of this. In any case, I wrote a book, as you mentioned, about 15 years ago on anger in America, and it was to some degree a warning that unless we get a handle on this new fad of being angry all the time and enjoying or luxuriating in our anger, there were going to be extreme consequences. Of course, you know, warnings like that are seldom heeded, and mine wasn't, and no surprise. But it did seem to me the time had come to revisit the topic. So I went back at it this time with a fairly close attention to what has happened since Trump's election in 2016, but very specifically on what's happened in the last 2 years. This was a kind of can't-miss topic in that everybody knows the country is extremely agitated and polarized. The question is not so much if that's the case, but can we get further into what the nature of the anger is and what we might be able to do about it? So that's what this book was. It's titled Wrath because I was looking for something that captured this particular intensification of anger. And also, I think the situation that arises when people are angry, but the normal paths of expression are cut off. And I think that describes what, for those of us who think of ourselves as conservatives, and I do, feel that what has happened in the last 9 or 10 months has been a situation in which we can't even express ourselves publicly without being at risk of being canceled or worse. People have been arrested, Charges have been brought. Legal actions have been taken. We have the FBI referring to people who protest at school board meetings that they are domestic terrorists.
Yeah.
Well, that happened after I wrote the book, but I think it captures perfectly the drift of things, that we are in a situation whereby the sorts of disagreements and anger that we might have, you know, yelled at each other about in the past has gone beyond that. We're no longer allowed to raise our voices or even make calm, rational arguments if we're on the wrong side of what the mainstream press determines or the government authorities determine are illegitimate opinions.
Yeah, I think
when have we had this before? I don't think we have.
No, I don't think so either. I think as the last few years, it just seems like things are ramping up and ramping up, and we're having more violent crime in all of our cities. It's like people are just.
And then we're told we're not allowed to call it violent crime because it's a protest.
Yeah, and it just seems like people are starting to lash out. And I think what do you think the you know, now we have this 24-hour news cycle where people are tuned in to almost instantaneous news around the country. What effect do you think that has on people?
Well, I think it's an accelerant to anger. Accelerant in two ways. It makes it more intense because it feeds on itself, and it also just speeds things up. Once an aggravation is named, millions of people will learn about it within minutes, maybe hours, and then we are off to another cycle of denunciation, oftentimes very ill-informed denunciation. I think of what happened with the Rittenhouse verdict. You know, there are a great many Americans who believe that the two people that Rittenhouse killed were African-Americans. And that he was showing up to engage in some kind of racial vendetta. Nobody who paid any real attention to the trial thinks that, but it's out there in our instant news cycle, nonetheless.
Right.
So misinformation gets amplified into sort of settled belief very quickly. And once it's settled belief, talking people out of it becomes really difficult.
Sure, because then you're a heretic again.
Yeah. What is, tell me this, we talk about anger. I mean, lots of folks are angry out there about numerous topics. What's the difference between anger and wrath?
Well, the dictionary or the thesaurus might say there's not much of a difference, but the distinction that I try to draw is between anger as something that is potentially settled. You and I disagree strongly about this. Maybe we've lost our tempers, but we expect at the end of the day that we're going to settle this. We're not going to kill each other over it. There's some proportionality in anger.
Mm-hmm.
Husbands and wives get angry. Parents and their children get angry. But at the end of the day, these things tend to be settled. Wrath doesn't permit that. I make the suggestion in the very beginning of the book that what anger says is, how dare you ask or how dare you say that? But wrath comes in with simply, I will destroy you. It's a view that what you've done is so far beyond anything that I can ever accept or forgive that I have no choice left but to wipe you out. That kind of wrath, I think, is also, it's not just a more intense form of anger. It has about it a quality of treating this as a collective vendetta that has to be taken all the way. So I have friends, for example, who now talk about America as on the verge of civil war. Some say it's a cold civil war, but that language of civil war is implying that there's no way we're going to just talk this through to a conclusion. Now, I have other friends who think that this can be settled by talking it through and finding a reasonable compromise.
And I have to say, I don't find their argument quite as believable. The differences between people who think that we don't need national borders and those who want the national borders maintained can't really be compromised. You can't compromise away after you have left Afghanistan and left hundreds, maybe thousands of people behind and all those weapons. The room for compromise is gone.
Yeah, you've got to have some middle ground there somewhere, and there isn't.
Well, and, you know, Joe was supposed to come in and make everything, you know, it was Trump that was making everybody angry. You know, he was the reason people were angry, and it's like, huh, well, we've left him in the rearview mirror, basically, except the media can't stop talking about him. And yet, that vengeance.
That level of anger.
But you look at the vengeance. You know, what are they doing? They're sicking the FBI on parents at school board meetings and all that. And I really think that your treatment of anger versus wrath in the book, although that seems like a, like you could just read the dictionary definitions and be done with it, I think you explore that in such an interesting way, because I'm not sure people really need to think about that. I think we all need to think about that. I mean, wrath is like a burn the place to the ground, even if it kills all of us. Like
scorched earth.
It's a mutually assured destruction type of model, rather than I'm just expressing my, you know, like anger.
Well, you know, I have trouble describing this book to people who haven't taken a look at it, because on one level, it seems like it's just a statement of the obvious. Americans are angry with each other right now. Tempers are heated. There isn't any easy way to compromise this. What's the point of writing a book about it? What I've been trying to do is just tease this out at another level. There's more to it than political anger.
Yes.
We're experiencing this as a political standoff, but much of the book is devoted to trying to dig out where this came from. We weren't always angry in this way. Of course, humans have a capacity to be angry at any old time, and America, with its history of the revolution and civil war and many smaller wars in between, has a history of acting on anger at some point. So what's different between then and now? And that, I think, is something that is worth really thinking about. Part of the argument of the book is that for most of our history, we were a nation in which the guiding principle was to engage in self-control, or to put it in a slightly different way, self-government. Self-government meaning not just electing our leaders, but governing ourselves as individuals and within our communities. That ethic of self-control has faded away, and there's a history to that, probably too long a history to take into the radio program, but at least part of it, I think, can be mentioned, and that is way back in the 1950s, we began to get the first cracks in that older ethic of self-control. It came in with the importation to the country of Freudian psychoanalysis, which had as one of its messages that if you repress your anger, it's going to come back at you as neurosis.
So well, that's right. We've got to let everything out. Hold that thought, Peter. I don't want to break this up, because I think that's a really good point, and it's something for folks to ponder. And seriously, the book does, the title does seem like something very obvious, but I have to say, in reading it, every single page was like, hey, Bill. Yeah. I basically, you know, sat down and read him the book. So it was something you really want to share, because they're ideas that I think we need to get a grip on. We'll be right back. Our guest is Peter Wood. His book is Wrath, America Enraged. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
You'd change the weather, start a little storm, make a little rain. But I'm gonna do one better, hide the sun until you pray. I'm a tornado, looking for a soul to take.
never seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on.
I couldn't resist, because you did a really good job in the book of kind of peeling that song apart and the history of that song and the different versions that there have been. And as I looked for a version to play today, they're all like Mormon Tabernacle Choir, you know? It just sounds so pretty. And you listen to the words in the backdrop of your book, and it's like, Yikes. Trampled down the vineyard where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Well, you know, it was a religious hymn that the words that we're most familiar with come from Julia Ward Howe in the midst of the Civil War. And she rewrote them, and but it has remained a song that gets revived almost every time there is a really deep cause. It was, I think, most recently it was the hymn taken up by Martin Luther King Jr. But in between that, it's been a theme song for political campaigns. Teddy Roosevelt used it, and it does have a fascinating history.
Yeah, but I never, you know, you don't think about the wrath in that, but it's. That's exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Earlier you were you had mentioned self-control, and I think today it seems like people are unable to really maintain self-control as well as they have in the past. Why do you think that is?
Well, a lot of things, I think, go back to the habits we acquire when we're young, both as young children and as teenagers. It's in the family that we learn self-control, because children aren't born with it. They have to learn it.
Right.
And if parents encourage children to be free spirits, there's a certain cost to that. You may end up with the idea that you get your way when you have a tantrum. And carrying tantrums into adulthood is pretty unpleasant for other people, but I think we're now a tantrum-based society. So there's that. And then there's what happens in our teenage years, which are years when we're no longer specifically looking to our parents for the sort of emotional formatting we take on. We learn it from our peers. One of the avenues in which we're all very strongly affected during those teen years is popular music. Popular music offers a pattern of how we should behave towards each other, especially people of the opposite sex. And those songs once were kind of romantic ballads, which still exist, of course, but we also now have whole genres of anger music in which the man or the woman expresses nothing but high disdain for the jerk who rejected him or her. And that's part of the patterning, I think, that goes out of popular culture and then eventually comes back into politics.
Yeah, and it's very, very popular right now, too. I mean, you're right. In pretty much everything from rap to country music, there's a lot of anger, a lot of anger songs.
Well, I think you're... your point's well taken that in the 1950s, that did come in where, because it used to be, you know, get over it and move on, and you didn't, I mean, having a tantrum in the 20s, 30s, 40s, I mean, any time previous to just, unless you were a thug, you walked away or, you know, punched him in the face and walked away or.
Yeah, I mean, we had, a lot of models in popular culture before World War II, in which the idea was that the really tough guy was the one who didn't give in to the provocations. Think of Gary Cooper in High Noon or classic Westerns where there were plenty of reasons for the hero to get mad, and maybe he did, but he kept it in until there was that final moment when there was the showdown with the bad guys. But even then, he didn't act in anger. He acted in duty. That's all changed. I mean, we just go on Amazon or Spectrum or someplace where there's lots of old movies, and what you will find is a culture that respected self-control. Go there and look at what's out there today, and we find that the hero is one who champions self-expression. I do it my way, and my way is going to be 9 times out of 10 pretty violent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right. Back then, it was expected to have that self-control, and that's what made you the better person. Today, not so much.
Well, today, yeah, you take your car and drive through a Christmas parade and mow people that you've never even met.
Well, I think down.
That's a thing. It's like the anger isn't even focused.
Right. I think that is an aspect of what I'm calling wrath, is when you're ready to break out, it doesn't matter who
right.
you hurt. So driving down people in a Christmas parade is a good expression of how I feel, regardless of how it makes anybody else feel.
Mm-hmm. But we're seeing that break out in so many places now. It's becoming almost a cultural thing to express yourself that way, and it's okay, because I mean, if you listen to the media, it's really not their fault that they did that, and that would have never been accepted back in the day. I mean, if you did something like that, I mean, you get hung up by your toes. But today, it's let's analyze this and figure out why it happened. And, it's really not their fault that it happened. It's somebody else's fault. And I think people are really getting kind of fed up with that. And because, I mean, there's a lot of people around that remember the way it used to be.
Yeah, that was considered...
Yeah, out of line.
Unacceptable.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it is cultural change, and that this freewheeling and usually angry expression has caught on with many millions of Americans, but not with all of us. There's clearly a counter movement of people who are urging us back into older forms of self-restraint. That is part of the division in our country. And I don't want to say that the anger is all on one side or on the other. There's plenty of anger on both sides, but it differs a bit in character. There's one side that is proudly angry, that views anger as a form of social justice. It's getting your way. It's about time that we set the record straight. So many injustices in the past, and what can we do now but get angry over them?
Mm-hmm.
And there's the other side that says, well, there may have been injustices in the past that still require some effort to address, but let's do this in a rational way. Let's respect one another as best we can and figure out how to get along. Those two sides are both fueled by some degree of indignation about how things have happened, but they do not come out as expressing themselves in the same way. My account of this is that the protest movements that started to congeal in the 1950s and really broke into a riot of the 1960s were partly of this liberated form of anger. Some of it came from importation of European ideas after World War II, the existentialists who thought that the only authentic life was one that threw off the bounds of restraint and just let it rip. So you get that along with this psychological stuff, let's be healthy-minded and not hold our anger back. And it comes together in this form of a individual self-expression as the highest ethic. There's nothing that really should restrain you. All that is just the artificial, phony stuff that society puts on you. If you're going to be real, you're going to be angry. You're going to be angry over the indignities done to you and to the injustices that you think have been done to others. That became a way of life, a lifestyle, so to speak, and one which has been taken up by so many Americans now that it's hard to have a conversation across these lines. Now, I live in New York City, in one of the most liberal neighborhoods of New York City. So virtually all my neighbors and people I work around are of this point of view, that self-expression is the highest value and that holding things back is somehow illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of that is that there's just a lot of stuff that we should be talking about, which we can't. We can't because people will just boil over with anger the moment you say, want to talk about irregularities in the 2020 presidential election. The mere mention of that possibility says that you're complicit in the big
lie.
Yeah,
it's like immediately we know what side you're on, you know? I mean, that's really what's happened to us is everybody has a side now, and we don't cross the line. And that makes it very difficult to have open conversation and some sort of compromise when you have these raw feelings right at the surface and not necessarily all the facts.
Well, they're not real productive. And, I mean, you have organizations, BAM, by any means necessary?
Yes.
You know, so it's okay. Anything you do in furtherance of the cause is okay.
Right. By any means necessary has been a big player in California's efforts to overturn Proposition 209, and I've had dealings with them in the past. I take their name seriously. When they say by any means necessary, they mean any. They're perfectly ready to turn to violence to get their way, and that's one of these lines that gets crossed that you can't uncross once it's out there. So, you know, we're now all over the country looking at the coastal California and seeing this wave of looting and rioting. It's a orchestrated use of violence that, you know, the acts in and of themselves are not angry, but they're justified as anger. This is something we can do because we've suffered an injustice and we're getting our own. So that's another, I think, important aspect of talking about anger and wrath, and that it's operating on us even when we are not personally angry. It has become this wraparound excuse for doing all sorts of things. If you look at the people who are caught on video in the midst of riots in Portland or wherever, frequently they don't look angry. They're having a ball. They're having a good time. The expression of anger in the form of social license, rioting, and so forth, is a jolly occasion for people while they're doing it. Even when they're inflicting grave harm on other people, they are still kind of happy about it much of the time. Now, that's a paradox here, that anger and happiness can be so closely linked.
Right.
That's nonetheless something you've got to think through. People want to be angry because anger feels good. Anger is not just a sense of being powerful, but it's also a sense of being righteous. And those are sort of dangerous ingredients to put together.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, the idea that you can work with people like that is, I think, kind of fictional. At that point, you're not dealing with people who are rational. I haven't gotten to the end of the book, so I kind of did want you to spoiler alert us on like how you see this playing out or what people can do, because there are a lot of people, a lot of conservative people that are really just being silenced, because now they're thinking, well, gee, you know, if I go to the, like where a lot of people are going to the school board isn't a big deal. But in a lot of places, that is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a big deal, then, well, maybe I shouldn't say anything. Maybe I shouldn't send this email. Maybe
I've got too much to lose to get involved with this fight. And
yeah. You know, so, it's a
lot of intimidation.
Sure. And that's what the left wants, is to silence the other side. And I think, you know, we run the risk that that kind of may work, but that doesn't ever work long term. You can't do that to people long term and expect them to take it. When we come back, I want you to get into that, how this plays out, what people can do, and since you've looked at this for a long time, long enough to write a book about it, you know, what's your recommendation to people on how they not just deal with it, but maybe can be effective? How's that? We'll be right back. Our guest is Peter Wood. The book we're discussing is Wrath, America Enraged. We'll be right back at WeThePeopleRadio.us. I think that's kind of where a lot of people are right now. What a scary theme song. All those people out there that you think are paying attention to their driving or just pushing a shopping cart, you know, walking along, look perfectly normal, all ready to blow.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Peter? What pulls them out of the trees?
Well, what pulled them out of the trees initially was this combination of mass mobilization of the use of social media to instill instant reactions to aggravations. If I had to say the relative short timeline on this is that after the Bush-Gore election in 2000, the left got really, really angry, and that was the stimulus to my first book on the topic. There was something new in this anger, and I called it new anger. It's a flamboyant, self-regarding, look-at-me anger. So it's not just being angry, but being angry in a way in which you expect to be applauded for your anger. So when you put the social rewards together with the sense of aggravation, you get this formula for sustained anger as a way of conducting political campaigns, as a way of mobilizing the people on your side. Now, I'll say this as someone who did vote for Trump twice. I thought he, too, was somebody who played with anger.
Just a little.
It wasn't his most endearing quality in my mind, but there was a element here in which the two sides began to catch up with each other. Each was mobilizing its support by tapping into the social resentments and essentially informing people that if you vote for me, I will act on this. Well, there's plenty of other parts of the political world, too, and we don't need to go into all of those. But part of this was priming of Americans, wherever they stood politically, to think that anger was going to be their best resource. So, you know, it turns out that there's a half-truth to that. It is a way of getting people to vote or to show up and protest, but it's not a very easy way to direct and control where people are going to go with it. So where we are now, I think, is that the American left is in a position of almost perpetual gloating. I think it has something of a guilty conscience, and that while there is hot denial that there is anything mischievous about the 2020 election, everybody really knows there was. There were many millions of dead people voting and people who didn't actually vote, whose ballots got filled in, and that sort of thing. The troubled conscience is not a good recipe for calming people down either, in that when you've done something wrong and aren't willing to confess it, it becomes the stimulant for still more imposing sorts of behavior. And there we are with the country divided now between those who hated Trump so much that they were willing to mortgage their consciences to get him out of office, and those who feel so aggrieved that the election was stolen that they are losing faith in the ability of the country to offer them the consent of the governed or genuine self-government. It's the rise of a regime that has bypassed the ordinary means of gaining legitimacy in the eyes of the people. With that sort of standoff, I think that what we have to look forward to is a great deal more and more heated forms of angry expression. The great fear is that this will break down into outright violence. Well, of course, it already has broken out to outright violence as far as riots have gone and the willingness of some people to basically perpetrate atrocities like the guy with the SUV in Kenosha. We are, or Waukesha, I should say, the answer to this, if there is an answer, lies, I think, mostly in those school board meetings where you're seeing people who show up and are willing in a tough-minded way to assert their own views of things and to call out the essentially the theft of our public education system by the radicalized left. It's all been done pretty openly, and it has resulted with threats from the FBI and the White House that people who resist are going to be treated as domestic terrorists. But enough of us are standing up against that that it seems to be having an effect. So we saw the way the elections went in Virginia and some other places, New Jersey, here in New York, on Long Island. It was almost a complete sweep of the school boards that were in the hands of the radical left. All of this points to at least the possibility that we may be able to regain control of the country through electoral means, provided we have the stamina to prevent the further erosion of the integrity of our elections. And that's the hot issue right now. I get the New York Times every day to get my own dander up, and it's full of stuff about how terrible it is that the Republicans might insist on election integrity, because that's just going to mean the stealing away the votes from the underrepresented. It's a bizarre sort of controversy to be in, that the desire to see that elections are run on the fair and square basis is now seen itself as a kind of attack on the way things should be done. So we're faced with a standoff between two sides, both of which are really ready for a dust-up. I hope above all that conservatives understand that as soon as they do resort to violence, the left will seize on that to crack down on the country far more than it already has. And therefore, fine, let's keep our Second Amendment. If you want to have arms and ammunition handy, fine, but don't go out and start shooting people. And the temptation to start shooting people is certainly there when you see the mass looting and riots, the possibility of breakdown in real social order that threatens you and your family and your property is ever present. Trying to figure out a way to suppress the destructive wave that is sweeping across the country without giving in to the impulse to act destructively. I thank God that we've got a lot of veterans who know how to handle weapons but who aren't going to be tempted to misuse them. I think they need to set an example for other people who are not quite so trigger disciplined. I think we need to be sure that we can find ways to resist the illegitimate usurpations of government authority that are all around us. In my mind, that includes the efforts of the federal government to impose vaccination on people who don't want it. I'm vaccinated. I'm okay with that, but I fully understand people who don't want to be. And there is another one of those things where real resistance is possible. Now, those are, school boards and vaccinations are not things which normally would incite people to violence, and I don't think they will, but they do provide a model for how, if you are in the grips of wrath, you can find ways to express it and live it out and deal with it that fall short of turning to violence.
Yeah, there just seems to be, in today's time, so many different overreaches. You have, like you say, the election integrity, abortion right now is a hot topic. You've got the border. You've got all the looting and social justice thing pounded on people. You've got in the West, you've got, water wars practically breaking out over, the use of water. All these things, I think, are contributing to the unhappiness of our population. And what do you, I mean,
I well, guess, so do, much do, of do, it, do, like, especially the water and that is predicated on lies.
Yeah, that's
phony,
what I mean.
Phony
I mean,
science. I mean, you can't fight against it because
there's so much of it that's just based on misinformation and I don't know. Do you see what's your prediction? I mean, it just seems like it's just getting
you hold
worse
that card up
and
your
worse
forehead
and worse.
And do like the Johnny Carson, like
yeah,
the Swami thing.
Yeah, yeah. What where do you see this going? I mean, it's they say, oh, it can't get any worse. Well, it can get a lot worse. But what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't like to be in the position of having to say this, but I guess I'll say it anyway. I think things will get a lot worse, and that we are at this point where both sides can't win. One side or the other will win, and the side that loses is going to be mighty unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're left here with is a showdown. There's going to be some crisis that brings all this to a head. It could be the abortion issue. The Supreme Court's about to act on that, and it looks to me like either way it acts, there's going to be some people.
Yeah,
who are
somebody's not going to be happy. Yeah.
What I don't want to happen is for the cold civil war to turn into a hot one. But what really will happen is, well, there are going to be sporadic occasions where some terrible things happen, and the American people are going to be tested as to how they respond to that. Mm-hmm. We allow ourselves to be driven to an even greater pitch of angered excitement, or do we find some road back to being people who may not always like each other, but realize that we have something to deeply care about in trying to maintain a republic. Now,
right.
There are, of course, other people who have no interest in maintaining that republic, and that's what makes this thing so hard. They view the American past, as I wrote about in my last book, that this has been a nation of nothing but oppression and ill will, and the only good thing to do would be to replace it with something else.
Well, you have a lot of people who are really frustrated with all the things that have happened, and unfortunately on the right, a lot of times that ends up in, well, I'm not going to vote anymore.
Right.
Okay, well, that actually is not helpful. We had like 450,000 Republicans in the state of California who didn't vote in the recall of Gavin Newsom. Well, we went to all the trouble of getting a recall on the ballot, and then people didn't vote because, well, they don't trust the system and yada, yada, yada. But at the very same time, a truck driver with $153 took a state Senate seat. So,
yeah. Well, I think another thing that we
can't just walk away from the system and expect it to fix itself.
I think another thing we have to consider, too, is in the past, it's always been some outside force that has brought our country back together and back together very quickly. And there are things happening in the world that could make that happen again. I mean,
yeah, if we don't pay attention,
and it may not be as good a result as it has in the past. But
there's three things on the horizon that in the foreign scope that could arouse Americans. There is Putin posing to invade Ukraine. There is China posing to invade Taiwan. And there is the eagerness of the Iranians to acquire and perhaps use nuclear weapons. Now, my own view of this is that Biden is going to do nothing about any of it.
We've hit the magical end that it's going to cut us off. We would love to have you back on again, though. Please talk to Stephen about doing that, because we have a lot more to ask you. And we would like people to read your book. It's called Wrath, America Enraged by Peter Wood. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Till something snapped inside, I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.